Okay, so interview with Michael Smith at Chapters Downtown Ottawa. Thank you very much for coming to Ottawa. I understand you're here for the 55 plus show.
I am here for the 55 plus lifestyle show, yes.
55 plus being a high demo for you, or?
I guess it is. I mean, it's certainly a demographic of folks that respect the issues of health and wellness and have the sort of disposable income that allows them to make good, solid food choices and perhaps the time to cook on a regular basis. So basically overcoming some of the impediments that slow down other demographics.
A lot of demographic, especially people with kids. And
yeah,
that's been one of your big things for a long time, family meals.
Yes, yes.
And the title of this book is Real Food, Real Good. And you lead with kind of a manifesto of sorts. So tell me what real food
you know what
means
it is
to you.
I'm 50 years old here in a couple of weeks, and I guess I've lost tolerance for beating around the bush. It's time to tell it like it is. And the simple fact is we've got a flawed food system in North America. We really do. We've got several basic premises at the center of it that just don't work. They don't hold water. One of them is this idea that processed food is an okay option. That's okay. And it's simply not. You know, letting a factory cook for you is one of the single worst life choices any one of us can make ever. And the other one is this idea that we're too busy. We're so busy being busy that we don't have time to be humans and just stop, pause, and cook simple food, you know? We also have this idea that food belongs on a pedestal. So much of food media puts food on a pedestal, and it leads to this idea that food is complicated or expensive or difficult or anything that somehow takes away the idea that I can do it, you know. And beyond that, we've created this. I guess because we're human beings, we've created this idea for ourselves that if I can't cook, well, it must be difficult. You know, it's unknown to me, therefore it's difficult. And I understand that. You know, I'm a pragmatic guy, but I'm not going to agree with you on that. Just because it's unknown to you doesn't inherently make it difficult. In other words, really, we're only talking about one thing here. There's really only one thing you got to do. It's make the choice. Get yourself informed and make the choice. Recognize and realize how important this is. This is not, oh, wouldn't it be nice? This is life. This is real. And in particular, if you're a parent, this is essential.
Right. One of the things that is my favorite section of the book, we just touched base on this, is the introduction, so-called foods. You talk about cake mixes and about the fact that they can live on shelves for years and never change.
Sure.
And my personal favorite is real, quote-unquote, juice.
Yeah,
and
you've seen it before. Real lemon, real lime, come on.
So I like this line. If a food processor feels compelled to call something real, chances are it isn't. How can people tell?
Well, first of all, if it's in a box or a can, I'd be a little suspicious. You know, and maybe we should back up a little higher level for a second, because I think it often comes as a shock to so many people how game this system is, how poorly enforced, how poorly written and regulated food labeling laws are in the first place. For instance, the words whole grain, it's certainly a button, hot button. You know,
oh, you're speaking my language.
Oh, yeah, we see this all the time, the words whole grain, and that just casts that healthy aura over something, but really, it means nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the word multigrain, ridiculously nothing. It means absolutely zero. You know, in some aisles in the supermarket, the word natural is heavily and highly regulated. In other aisles, you can say it whatever you want and call it natural. You know, I guess my point here is, first get informed. Recognize that your supermarket is full of pitfalls, that they don't care about you, that Big Food Inc. doesn't give a damn about you, that they're not somehow all of a sudden magically caring about your health and wellness and your kids and all of that. They're not. Quite the reverse. They've got boardroom tables that are full of way more lawyers and scientists than cooks. You know, people that could give a damn about us. And they're just looking for loopholes and ways to screw us, in effect.
And make a lot of money.
And make a shit ton of money doing it. You know, and we've got to do better. Worse yet, we have now created in North America a food system that externalizes its true costs. And I think most people just don't understand this. I don't think you're a dummy or something. I think legitimately, if you're at the supermarket and you've just filled up your cart and you're paying for it and you get the number at the bottom of the tape and you look at it and you think, I just paid X dollars for my food, you would think, yeah, well, that's what it costs. Why wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. But if your cart is full of processed food, that's not what it costs. Mm-hmm. We are externalizing the true cost of processed food. We hold it somewhere else in society. We hold it in our healthcare system. And we're surrounded by people that are pissed off at politicians, pissed off because apparently we don't fund healthcare enough. Well, the reality is there's more funding in healthcare than ever before in the history of the world. We're doing just fine funding healthcare. It's just that nobody will stand up and take personal responsibility for the choices we're making that are stressing out that healthcare system. When you look at all the things that push healthcare to the edge, most of them are directly attributed to processed food. We've got to stop this. This is a cycle of defeat.
Right. So your position isn't, if people are eating processed food, just let them be alone, they're happy?
No, it's not, because I think it's slow motion child abuse. I'm sick and tired of watching parents feed their kids breakfast candy. The worst possible thing you can do for a kid is send them out the door in the morning with their blood sugar spiking. It's just horrific how many poor children, and I don't mean economically poor, I mean, wow, we're doing this to our kids. We're feeding them and letting them eat all this crap, and their blood sugar's swinging wildly all over the map, mm-hmm, all day long, and that's their life.
Yeah.
That's what they know. So they're used to first being frantic and full of energy, but frantic energy, and then it plunges, and now they're depressed and they can't move, and then it's back up again. Meanwhile, we're supposed to just live our life just trucking along, you know, nice and normal, even keel, you know, okay, a little emotion now and then, whatever. But the children that are forced to endure that kind of life, that is not life. That's child abuse. We've got to do better.
Yeah, that's one of your big things in here. You talk about breakfast cereal.
I'd like to take some of these people and put them in a room and punch them in the eye. Like some of these executives at these big food companies, yeah, that are pandering all this crap to us and creating all these television ads and all these fun little cartoon characters trying to convince kids that breakfast candy is something they should eat, mm-hmm, every morning. And no. It's just bad, bad, bad. And somebody's got to stand up and tell it like it is. And frankly, I'm at that point in my life where I'm just going to tell it like it is. I could give a shit what people think. It's time to tell it like it is.
So pick me. Yes, like it is. This leads to my next question. Oh, you talk about the so-called foods. If there's one thing, if you could go into every kitchen, what would you throw out? Or does it all have to go?
Well, breakfast candy, that's a good place to start. Soda, absolutely. Okay. Liquid sugar.
Pure liquid
Oh, my God. Oh.
The cause of so much obesity.
Oh, man. Fruit juice. You know, we just don't know how gamed we are.
Yes.
It's just shocking. Like, what we can do to apples and get away with. So, Big Food Inc. knows this. You can take, mm-hmm, apple juice and you, mm-hmm, can strip out 100% of everything but the sugar and be left with pure fructose, you know, high-grade sugar, and you can still call it apple juice. You know, and you can load up other fruit juices with this apple, mm-hmm, sugar and put that, again, that healthy aura on a product, mm-hmm, and everybody believes, oh, I'm just drinking fruit juice. This is great. I'm drinking fruit juice. I'm happy. Well, guess what? You're drinking just as much sugar as you would if you were drinking pop. Chocolate milk. Here's another one. Let's take something really healthy, something that human beings have evolved to. We're the only species that drinks another mammal's milk, but we evolved for this. Let's take it and ruin it. Let's load it with sugar. You know, liquid sugar. Oh, my God. Liquid sugar is killing Canadians.
I think it's killing a lot more than Canadians, totally agree with you.
Yeah, it is.
When I look at this book, I think there are some really great recipes in here for families. Even just the tomato soup is such a simple thing that you can do for your family to make meals so much better.
Yeah.
What's your favorite takeaway for this for families?
Well, the book is split into two parts, mm-hmm. And really, we talk first. I mean, my strategy here, and I've thought this through, I'm really trying to be a resource here, and I think really, strategically, step one, get yourself informed.
Right. Okay. That's what the introduction become, is all about, and
exactly.
I love that.
You don't have to be a scientist, you don't have to go to school, you don't have to take web, you know, courses or anything, just get informed. You know, the fact is we're taken advantage of by Big Food Inc. every single day. So get informed. Understand.
Read labels.
Yeah, get informed. And then make that choice. I am going to do better. I'm going to cook real food for myself and for my family. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to overcome the hurdle, you know, the unknown, whatever it is. And I'm quickly going to realize this is not hard. This is not difficult. And that leads to the second part of the book, which is really just lots of simple, straightforward recipes and a very deliberate attempt to remind home cooks, whether they're experienced or not, that good food can be very simple. It does not need to be complicated or expensive or, you know, special tools, or you got to go to chef school or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just straight up, go for it. I'll tell you, cooks all over the world crave simplicity. Everybody in the kitchen is busy. Everybody's got something else to do. Nobody strives for complexity mm-hmm. in the kitchen unless they're a very well-paid chef. You know, and we're not chefs at home. We're cooks.
Even just on my blog, I've become so much more sensitive to the fact that it's time crunch for people. Mm-hmm. You know, I make a real serious effort to, it's like 45 minutes, and that's what I have mm-hmm. to put dinner on the table.
Yeah.
So I figure if it's longer than that, it had better be passive cooking so that I can sear it and put it in the oven,
right? Sure.
You know, something super simple. You've even got some slow cooker recipes in here.
Yep.
So I like it that it's very time sensitive for people too. You don't have to be complicated in order to make great food.
Having said that, though, there's a couple of recipes in this book that are straight up complicated. You know, like making that pho, making a proper bowl of pho is, I think it's actually called pho, that's crazy. But it's in the book. It's an outlier. You know, I always include one or two like projects.
It's good to challenge them.
You know, at heart, it is simple cooking. Like you can do it, but it's an attempt to show you that sometimes when we eat something like this, there's real integrity in it. There's real effort that goes into making these seemingly simple dishes that mm-hmm. we see on menus.
Yeah, and speaking of menus, you have a new menu because you just recently bought the Inner Bay Fortune with your wife, which is an amazing thing for you to do, sort of going back to your roots.
Yeah, full circle. Return.
Yeah. return. Yeah. How did that come about? And are you liking being an innkeeper?
Oh, we're loving it. We're 2 years into the project. I was 17 years away from this property. Never left. You know, we lived in Fortune. I did go to Halifax for a couple of years, but I've lived in Fortune basically the last 25 years. And just saw an opportunity last year and dived in. The inn had really had floundered. You know, it needed a refresh, it needed a reboot, and so we immediately set about rebooting the property. We've completely renovated the place, we gutted the main building, we've built public spaces, we tore one end of the building off and built my dream come true fire kitchen.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're
because
having
that
a grand
is
time.
That is a really significant investment, the fire kitchen. So it says on your website, it says 25-foot brick lined wood burning fire-breathing beast, the fireworks.
Yeah.
Are you having fun yet?
Yeah, we are. This is very real. And again, I think I there's a clear thread here between the book, really with everything I do right now. It's, you know, authenticity is something I think you start to crave as you gain wisdom. You know, when I cooked in the 90s, I spent 7 years there. I grew up as a chef there. Mm-hmm. I learned very profound things there. But I also spent all of my creative energy, all of my passion, trying to be provocatively creative, you know, trying to be the man, the big guy, you know, the best in the country, and all those things, and top 10, and we succeeded. We quadrupled the size of the business. But all these years later, I could give a shit. I'm not trying to impress people. I'm just trying to do something authentic that speaks to me. And really, for us, my wife and I, it came down to three simple things. We're gonna farm. We're going to grow every single thing we serve. We're going to cook it all with live fire. Nice. And we're going to serve it at feast tables. We're going to do it communally, family style. And man, we're having a good time.
That feast atmosphere promotes a lot of conversation.
Yes, it does.
So do you find people are on their phones at a feast table?
Not really. No, they're not. Not as much as you might expect. I mean, certainly there's a lot to take pictures of. There absolutely
is. I've seen
some. But it's really interesting to watch the dynamic in our dining room every night. And, like the farm and the fire thing didn't concern me at all. I mean, who wouldn't want to go to a restaurant that grows their own vegetables and cooks it all with live fire? Big deal. But the feast thing, the family style thing really scared us. It really did. There was no best practices out there. There was no other restaurant to go see how they did it. There was no book or...
Delis, yes, but restaurants, no.
Right? Yeah. It's just not there. So that was really risky for us. And now now that it's off and running and working so well, with 2020 hindsight, the clarity of looking back, I know that in effect what's happened is we've stumbled on to a largely unknown and definitely unmet, unfulfilled need in our society. So there's so many of us running around, in particular 20-somethings, 30-somethings, younger generations, running around, busy being busy, doing their thing, and so busy that they don't have time to come together around food, around the table. And couple that with the simple fact that as human beings, we are still very much the same human beings that were running around in the woods looking for roots and berries 1,000 years ago, because evolution can't keep pace with civilization. Put all that together, we have this unmet need. In other words, we are human beings. We crave human connection. We crave connection around food. It is literally in us. It is hardwired into our soul. And anthropologists and sociologists will tell you this. And so when we present that opportunity to our guests, and sometimes it's a surprise to them. They don't necessarily understand what's about to happen when they come to my restaurant. But when they get there and they sit down and they delve into it, they quickly come out of themselves. They rediscover that basic inherent human function of let's just connect around food. Right. Let's relax. Let's talk. Let's ignore our phones. Let's be with other people. And this is humanity at its best. It truly is.
I worked for a corporation at one point in time, and they brought me in out of their radio station, one of their radio stations, to be in their corporate marketing department. And shortly after that, they stopped allowing anyone within the marketing and or management teams to sit down and have a meal with people.
Wow.
We were no longer allowed to share a meal with a client.
Wow. Cost cutting.
No.
No.
No, they didn't want... They didn't want it to seem like there was any kind of friendship.
Wow.
And to me, that's
ass
why they...
backwards.
Yeah, they brought me in because I had all these great relationships, and then they cut me off of actually maintaining relationships with people. And shortly afterwards, I was laid off, which is, how I went into the kitchen. But
sure.
I always found it very interesting that was the way that they severed that connection. You are no longer allowed to eat with people.
Crazy.
You can meet, just don't eat. Yeah. I was going to ask you about, a lot of restaurateurs are finding that it's very, very difficult to get and maintain and keep good staff nowadays. It's a labor shortage. Have you experienced any of that going back?
Yes and no. We set a very high bar for our project.
I bet you did.
So we have no lack of folks that want to come and join the fun and be a part of it. Having said that, though, millennials are a very different generation in the kitchen than what I was used to years ago. They're not equipped to work the long hours. They're not ready to work 6 days a week. They want 2 days off, and
they want them in a row.
And they want them in a row, and they don't. And I'm choosing my words carefully here because I've got some really good, strong, passionate people around me. I'm very proud of, but I've also had to deal with a few bad apples, and unfortunately, one of the underlying issues, shockingly, is that they're so malnourished. They're 20-something cooks. They don't eat the food we cook. I mean, I, out of my own pocket, hire and employ a family meal cook. Every single day, I put my cooks at a table. My ingredients from the farm, we feed them, they eat, they come together. It's important to me, yes. But what do you think they're eating for breakfast?
It's very Adrian Farrar.
What do you think they're eating when they get home at night?
Yes.
And they're, they're all drinking sports drinks and the, you know, and pop, and they're malnourished. They can't, they don't have that go-go energy. Now, this isn't everybody, but I've certainly had to deal with a few bad apples, and this is one of the underlying issues, is they're just malnourished. They're not, they don't take care of themselves.
That is so interesting.
Right? I find it fascinating. This is one that I'm going to be thinking a lot about. This is one, this is now my next,
That's almost like, you know, when a cobbler's kids have no shoes, right?
So think, and I'm so aware of that. To me, I set a high bar for myself and for those around me and for the project. And what's the point in having this passionate team of cooks, young cooks, cooking up their hearts, yet they themselves are not absorbing all these wonderful food lessons around them. They themselves are not eating real food and enjoying the real food. They just see it as work. They may be passionate about it. They may absolutely be passionate about it, but they haven't made the personal connection yet. And it's reminding me that I went through the same thing. You know, when I was a chef in my 20s, it was all about the guest and the food and the provocative and all of it. But it really wasn't until my son was born, when I became a dad, that I started paying any attention whatsoever to nutrition.
Right.
So now today I find myself employing millennials that don't know how to take care of themselves. I mean, sure, they cook.
Yeah.
And some of them are very passionate about food in their own lives. So I'm being very careful here on my words. I'm not throwing shade on the whole thing. But there
people
are bad apples.
Michael, make note, he's not bad-mouthing all of you.
No,
but those,
no,
there's
but
that
no
few,
and the bad
right?
apples are gone. I've told you, know, they cull themselves.
Yes,
you know?
They do, don't they?
But they can't keep up. They can't keep up physically. They can't keep up mentally. They start externalizing from themselves. Everything, all the problems are external to themselves. They don't take personal responsibility. It can be really interesting.
Well, and it's funny because one of my favorite lines from the introduction, you talk about the need for real food, and you talk about a lightness of being and
yes,
energy.
Yes, yes.
You know what? I think that's the first time I've ever read that in a book that isn't like a woo-woo vegan book.
Sure.
You know, because there a lot of that's out there. But it's the first time I've read somebody that, you know, the way that you cook is very grounded in omnivore cooking. And so I loved reading that, you know, that lightness of being.
Well, and I feel it. Like, I live this. And I know, in general, when I'm on the road, that's when it's hard for me.
Yes.
Okay. Now, not everywhere. Like, I had a really nice lunch today. Get my vegetables, all good. But there are times, depending on where I am or what I'm doing, where I have to endure day after day after day of heavy food. And I feel it. Like, it reminds me of how important this is. And I know plenty of people who have had that epiphany in their lives, changed their lives, and woken up the next day just blown away by how much better they feel.
Yes.
It's astonishing how important this is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's incredibly important here. You can change your life by not weighing yourself down with all this added sugar and, you know, all these chemicals, all these things that are not fully understood, that are...
And they don't assimilate into the body.
No, they just create havoc and leave.
Right. Especially for little brains.
Yes.
All those little connections that they don't make. So I wanted to sort of wrap up this part of the interview with a question.
Sure.
That is near and dear to my heart, because this is a very difficult industry. Particularly for women, I find that it's a real, you know, they chew you up and spit you out. So if, because you're a very passionate man, so if you had never had the success that you'd had, if you'd never written a book, if you'd never had any television success, if you were still struggling to make ends meet and still, you know, in the kitchen, you know, having a difficult time, would you still be in food?
I think so. I know at heart what drives me is a desire to create experiences for other people. And as a restaurateur now, more than just a chef, that's what excites me. I really treasure that. I really sweat the details. And it's just, I guess what I mean by that is that hospitality's in me. It's how I'm wired. You know, so yeah, I guess I think I would be. It's rhetorical, of course, so hard to answer accurately.
It's tough to say, you know, at this point in your life.
But I guess I can say that my core values wouldn't change.
Right.
You know, who I am as a person wouldn't change. I didn't become ethically or, you know, or socially or morally motivated because I'm a chef. You know, it would be the reverse, right? So, yeah, I think I'd hold on to my values, and I know I love making great experiences for other people, putting them at ease, feeding them, you know, I love that.
I often, people ask me why I'm in food, and I say, well, I have a deep need to feed. You know, I love to feed people. It's what I do, whether it's, you know, with photos or with words or, you know, I market food as well. Sure. So, you know, whether it's marketing for me or somebody else, but that nourishing of mind, body, soul, you know, becomes a huge part of, and it's who you are.
Yes, and it is. And I think in essence, in any vocation, in any calling, in any career, the folks that really succeed are the ones that found who they are and then found a way to express that through their work. You know,
brilliant.
I mean, but think of it. I mean, it's logical, right? Like if you're in touch and in tune with who you are as a person and you can manifest that through your career, I mean, it just, everything clicks, right? It all makes sense.
That's when, I think that's when you stop struggling. You know, even if you might be having difficulty financially or, you know, in your relationship, I think you stop struggling when you truly know in your heart that you're in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's struggling with that right now, so I thought I would ask that. Sure. So we're probably going to wrap things up now, so I'm going to do a rapid fire, if that's okay.
Okay, let's do it.
So it's 10 questions, as quickly as we can, and so it's all around food.
Sure.
So I'm having some fun with that. So who's the first chef you ever worked with?
His name was Brett Fairbanks.
And where was that?
That was at a convention center in Rochester, New York.
That sounds like fun.
Yep, food service.
What's your favorite go-to treat?
French fries.
It's very PEI of you. Most important skill in the kitchen?
Taste.
That's a big one. For breakfast, waffles or pancakes?
Pancakes.
Pancake guy.
It's funny because that's a pig to pay in my house every Saturday morning. Is it waffles today? Is it pancakes today?
And when you're kicking back, beer or wine?
Beer.
Any particular favorites right now?
I love my IPAs. You know, I love big hoppy beers.
It's a good beer. Besides your knives, favorite tool in the kitchen?
Spoon. Tasting.
Okay, good one. Favorite ingredient of the moment?
What would it be right now? Well, right now, fresh tomatoes. Bluefin tuna.
Oh.
Bluefin tuna.
You're very fortunate where you are. It sure is, yeah. And the recipe your kids love the most that's published?
Pancakes.
Okay.
Excellent. Oh, yeah. It's part of our ritual. Yeah.
Excellent. I love these pancakes. They look terrific, the oatmeal pancakes. So fill in the blank. When you're visiting PEI, don't miss blank.
Food.
I'm with you there. And last but not least, food bloggers. Love them, hate them, tolerate them.
Love them. Hey, anybody who's adding to the conversation around food, we're all in this together. Are you kidding? Why? I don't get the whole food bloggers, you know, like the old guard media running scared, throwing shade on the new, not really understanding how social media works and all that. I just don't get it. Like we see resistance to disruption in all industries for all time. So, you know, I understand the psychology behind it, but I mean, look around us. There are buildings in this town empty that used to be filled with media because the media just couldn't get into the new headspace, couldn't embrace social media. So of course I love food bloggers.
Excellent. Love that. I just thought I would ask that and have some fun. Excellent. Thank you very much.